Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Steven Pinker, whose latest book is titled The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. Steven Pinker is author of books such as The Language Instinct, The Blank Slate, The Better Angels of Our Nature, How the Mind Works, The Stuff of Thought, cognitive scientist, linguist, Harvard professor, and chair of the usage panel at the American Heritage Dictionary. Steven Pinker, this book is very different from your other books, your other popular books as opposed to the academic books, in that you're creating a kind of style guide rather than just explaining how the mind works or how language arises. So I want to start there. It seemed to me that you had a couple of reasons for writing this book, one of which was that I guess you wanted to apply some of your skills to writing a book about how we talk and how we write. But the other reason seems to me is that you got really tired of reading bad academic papers.
Among others, my private source of pain is having to read articles in my own field. And ironically enough, my own field is, or at least one of my fields, is language. And you would think that language scientists would be the ones who could best deploy the resources of language to express themselves clearly. But it hasn't worked out that way. And I thought that with a combination of my own personal experience in crossing over from academic to more popular writing, and the fact that language is what I study, that I could bring them together and figure out what it is about the way the mind handles language that could be translated into advice on how to write more clearly.
What was the trigger that got you to go, oh, I'm going to write this book?
It was clumsy copy editing job on my previous book, where the copy editor turned pretty much every passive sentence into an active sentence, because there is a guideline, good as far as it goes, to avoid the passive voice, and academics do overuse it. But I knew as someone who studies language, that the passive voice couldn't have survived in the English language for 1,500 years unless it served some purpose, and it does serve a purpose. And while it is true that academics overuse the passive voice, it's not true that the passive voice should always be avoided. And there were a number of other cases where I could see that the editor was following some style tips mindlessly, that is, not really understanding why they were offered in the first place, and with no real understanding of how language worked that would allow a judicious application of those rules. And many rules in style manuals are just commandments. They're lists of do's and don'ts. They're not based on any conception of what makes prose easy or hard to understand.
Yet at the same time, what happens is that when we hear something wrong, we go, but sometimes we shouldn't, and I'm trying to understand the relationship between why we cringe at certain things and maybe why we shouldn't and how to change that.
Mm-hmm. We cringe for a number of reasons. One of them is that the language is always changing. Some of the changes are temporary. There'll be a fad word. It will come in, it will go out, and the language will have forgotten about it. But others change the language permanently. And when it happens on our watch, when young people are changing the language, or some constituency that we aren't a part of, business people or sports people or musicians, it grates on our ear. It's not the language that we grew up with, and we misinterpret it as an error. The classic elements of style by Strunk and White has a lot of baffling advice simply because words that were novel in their day, they considered to be barbaric. Now it's hard to see what the fuss was about. To fix, meaning to repair, they consider this to be a semantic error. Fix can only mean make permanent or put in place. To finalize, they consider that to be a vogue bit of business jargon. To claim, meaning to assert as opposed to stake a claim. To contact, a verb from a noun. It used to be that contact was only a noun. So it grated on their ears. It doesn't grate on our ears because these words have become indispensable. But in our day, in our own time, people will make innovations and they will sound as bad to us as to contact sounded to Strunk and White, and our descendants may wonder what the fuss was about in our day.
Well, you say in your book, Sense of Style, Steven Pinker, you mentioned using the word axe for ask as kind of an example of that?
Well, that's just an error, or at least a variation of pronunciation. It goes back quite a ways. It's most characteristic in African-American English. It's a flipping of two phonemes, two consonants, which if you don't realize that this is quite common in language change, you could see as just a sign of ignorance. But many of our words originated from similar switches, sometimes called a metathesis, is the jargon. For example, the word bird used to be brid. Third used to be thrid, but our ancestors, somewhere along the line, flipped them, and it went viral, caught on, and the same could happen with axe. Unlikely, just because it's a minority who's not at the center of power who pronounces it that way, but it's happened before.
Several years ago, I wrote a novel that never sold, based in Hawaii, and I used a lot of pidgin in there, you know, and I was told pretty much, don't do that. We don't want people to learn that.
Oh, yes, right. That often happens certainly happens with pidgins and with languages of indigenous people, that they're often stigmatized as not being a language, as being substandard. And there's a rather sordid history of children being forced to abandon the language of their parents and grandparents, which is a shame because you don't have to lose one language in order to acquire another. So even though it certainly makes sense for anyone in our culture to master standard English, bilingualism imposes no cost on the brain, may even provide benefits. And so forcing kids not to speak a language really is a kind of cultural crime.
And at the same time, these grammar fascists that we have, you're sort of saying in your book that they're kind of trying to build a dam to hold back something that can't be held back at all.
Many times, yes. There are some conventions of grammar and spelling and punctuation that hold their own for long periods of time. And I do think that someone who is educated should know what they are, know how to write to conform to the expectations of a literate readership. But yes, some of them will change and there's nothing that anyone can do about them. Even though they're battered by change, manage to hold their own. So, for example, a disinterested, which is one of the bugaboos of language purists who get upset when people use it to mean bored as opposed to impartial or without a vested interest. The two senses have coexisted for at least 150 years. It turns out that the so-called incorrect sense, bored, was actually the original one, and the so-called correct sense predominated statistically for a while. The bored sense came back, but not so much as to drive out the unbiased sense. So often the rules that the purists defend, they're worried that if they don't hold the fort, they will disappear from the English language. But actually, they do pretty well. They hang around.
Well, the ones that obviously hang around the most are the ones that make for more coherent writing and talking, I would guess. I mean, the ones that might disappear don't matter.
Yes and no. There's a lot of language change that doesn't actually serve any clear function, but it's more like the ties get fatter, the ties get skinnier, the skirt lengths go up, the skirt lengths go down. There's a fair amount of arbitrary change in language, too, so it's not just a question of perfecting it so that we can communicate better and better and better.
When you're writing The Sense of Style, how often did these sorts of issues come up, and how did you resolve some of them, or did you just go, well, I'll give both sides and not worry about it?
I reserved matters of correct and incorrect usage. What is the correct meaning of to aggravate? Can you end a sentence with a preposition? Can you begin a sentence with and? What's a comma splice and should you avoid it? I sequestered all of them in the last chapter, partly because I think it's the least important part of good writing. I think it's well worth mastering, but it came last for a reason. And the guidelines that I used were basically the consensus of modern dictionaries and style guides. And contrary to popular misunderstanding, many of the purists' hobby horses do not find backup in the dictionaries and style manuals. You will not find a respectable dictionary or style manual that rules out split infinitives and fused participles and prepositions at the end of sentences. They all say they're fine. And the reason they say they're fine is they are fine. They're good writers use them, have always used them. If you try to obey these rules, you'll make your writing worse. Although a lot of sticklers will think that there are radical claims in the book, such as it's okay to end a sentence with a preposition, the advice is thoroughly conventional, and it was surprisingly easy to find sources that would back up the best practices of actual English writers as opposed to the smarty pants purists.
Let me go back to the notion of you as a cognitive scientist. How does that play into specifically, maybe you can give examples, into how you came to some of your determinations Where do you, Steven Pinker, reside in that?
Yes. Well, it's the book really is motivated by the idea that cognitive science has important lessons for writing. In fact, there's a sense in which all the lessons in good writing are ultimately applications of cognitive science, because it's the human mind that's doing the reading and the understanding and the reacting. And so our knowledge of what goes into writing a sentence, what goes into reading a sentence, where can they disconnect, is really where writing advice ought to come from. And I identify a number of cognitive processes that I think are key bottlenecks in crafting clear prose.
And it seems one of them is use of multiple double negatives, where, you know, we know it's kind of confusing and hard to kind of parse, but the reason it is because of things you've learned in cognitive science, that we slow down and we have to think about it, I guess.
That's right. In general, putting something in a negated form makes it harder to understand than the corresponding affirmative. So saying someone is dead and someone is not alive, they're pretty much the same thing, but not alive is harder. Except when there is a context set up where you're knocking down a belief that was plausible in the first place. And negation works if the reader has some reason to believe that something is worth negating. So if I say John Boehner is not a Muslim, that's an odd thing to process, and we have to think about it a couple of times, and we agree, yes, he's not a Muslim. If I say Barack Obama is not a Muslim, you understand that instantly, because there are these rumors that he is one, and so it's a plausible thing to have negated. So the two lessons, one, negation is hard cognitively, that is, we don't naturally think in negatives. To believe not X, we first have to believe X and then hang a little mental tag on it that says not, and that's two steps of cognitive heavy lifting rather than one. But negation does work when it's something that can plausibly be denied. So those are some lessons from cognitive science.
What did you find that surprised you? Did anything change for you as you were writing the book?
The part that I learned the most myself from, that I hadn't realized that there was a body of knowledge, is coherence. Coherence both in the sense of intellectual coherence, does your argument make sense, but also stylistic coherence, does one sentence follow from the preceding one? And there's a family of connectors in the English language. But, and, nonetheless, moreover, on the other hand, in contrast, similarly, which play a crucial role in knitting together the different sentences into paragraphs and essays and arguments. And there's a whole body of research in linguistics on what those connectors are, how they relate to each other, what ideas they convey. And I can see in badly written articles, and especially in badly written student papers, that a lot of what makes an argument incoherent is the clumsy or inept use of these coherence connectors.
Which plays a role overall in what we call syntax, right?
This is more semantics than syntax.
Can you explain the difference?
Yeah, so syntax is the assembly of words into phrases and sentences.
Okay.
The difference between, you know, the man bit the dog and the man the dog bit, and bit the man the dog. Only one of those is a syntactically acceptable sentence in English. Other languages have different syntactic rules, and so they can order the words differently. And the syntax also gives us a number of options. The man bit the dog. The dog was bitten by the man, it was the man that the dog bit, it was the dog that the man bit. And so syntax is basically the rules for rearranging the words. Semantics is what they mean. And so the difference between, moreover, he ate all the blueberries, and nonetheless he ate all the blueberries, is not a difference in syntax, because the words are in the same place, and if you were to draw a parse tree to diagram the sentences, they'd be identical. But the meanings of the words, nevertheless and moreover, are different. And so the way we understand those sentences in the context of what came before is different. So semantics is how language connects to knowledge and understanding.
Well, if we're looking at a paper that we've written, or book, or anything that we've written, and we want to get a proper sense of the semantics, what's the best way to go about doing it to make sure we got it right?
Probably it's the responsibility of the writer to lay out the ideas in a coherent sequence, to make it clear what the topic of the writing is, what the point of the writing is, to introduce ideas in an orderly fashion so that people can keep track of the players and not constantly wonder who the he or the it is referring to, and to connect the sentences with these. Sometimes you don't need to say the connectors explicitly. You could say that, you know, herons fly south in the winter, blackbirds fly south in the winter. You don't need to say similarly. It's kind of implicit. Yeah. But there are times when you really do need to say similarly if your point is to highlight the similarity between two successive sentences. Or it could be in contrast if you're highlighting the difference between them. For every idea that can be connected to another idea, there is a little device of English syntax or punctuation that allows the writer to make that idea clear.
It almost seems as if you're working on anything, I mean, other than writing email or things like that, having a second person look at whatever you're writing will always make sense, because there are so many issues that you can't necessarily see for yourself. And Steven Pinker, you talk about one of them, which is kind of a knowledge bias, that we don't really know what we know or what the reader is going to know.
Absolutely. And I think the main impediment to clear prose is a psychological shortcoming that we all have called the curse of knowledge. Namely, when you know something, it's very, very hard to imagine what it's like not to know it. It becomes second nature. You project your knowledge to the whole world. You think if you know it, everyone else does too. And so you don't bother to spell things out. You use abbreviations that are completely familiar to you, but that may not be familiar to your readers. You use vague abstractions, because you can visualize what you're talking about, but your readers can't. You use technical terms and jargon. You fail to spell out the connections between one idea and another, because it just all seems so obvious. And even if you follow the traditional advice, always keep in mind the reader over your shoulder. You know, always try to empathize and put yourself in the other guy's shoes and feel their pain and walk a mile in their moccasins and see the world from their point of view, all that stuff. And that's all very good. But there's only so far that we can do that, because we don't have mental telepathy. And there's, so there's no, you really can't know what another person really thinks and knows. You can guess, but you'll often be wrong. And there's no substitute for actually finding a reader and showing him the prose and saying, does this make sense to you? And you'll often find that what's obvious to you is not obvious to anyone else.
You talk in the book a lot about garden paths. What's a garden path?
Oh, yeah. So a garden path is a term very, very familiar among scientists of language for a misleading interpretation of a sentence partway through, a temporary or local ambiguity. So if I say, fat people eat accumulates, it's very hard to understand that sentence. It is a grammatical sentence. It's the fat which people eat accumulates, but you can leave out the and the which. But you get derailed as you understand it, because it just sounds like, first you hear fat people, and you think it's about fat people rather than about fat that people eat. So that's an extreme example. That's the kind you use in a textbook to illustrate the phenomenon. But it's surprising how much prose that just feels choppy and difficult, sentences that feel difficult to get through. The problem is that the writer has misled the reader into interpreting the sentence incorrectly, until the reader hits a brick wall partway through the sentence, has to backtrack, start all over, and figure out what the writer had in mind.
One writer friend of mine wrote novels, used to say that when he was writing, he always tried to create a movie in his head, and if he could picture something clearly, then he kind of understood that he was getting it clearly on paper. What do you think of something like that?
I think that's fabulous advice. The only problem is it can't just be that you, the writer, have the mental movie. Have you provided enough information so that the reader has the mental movie? And a huge amount of turgid, bloated, boring, incomprehensible writing is that way because the writer has not provided any way for the reader to form a concrete image of what he's talking about. Academic prose, professional prose, bureaucratic prose, all of them suffer from that shortcoming. So someone would say, we tested the subjects under conditions of good to excellent acoustic isolation. What he meant was, we tested the students in a quiet room. Or someone will talk about wildlife mitigation techniques, and what they mean is trapping birds. or I'm a digital media strategist. I help to develop strategies and timelines for the exploitation of digital communication. It means I teach companies how to use Facebook. There's example after example where the writer just doesn't allow the reader to actually visualize something, and that is way at the top of guidelines for good writing.
Well, sometimes it's deliberate if they want to obscure or if they're trying to sound smart.
It may be, and in fact, George Orwell called attention to that in his essay Politics in the English Language, which he said that euphemisms like collateral damage or transfer of populations can be used strategically to hide great crimes. But as I say in the book, I like to use Hanlon's razor, which is never attribute to malice that which can be adequately explained by stupidity. More often than not, it's not that the writer is deliberately trying to hide something, but just that the writer himself or herself thinks in abstractions, if they're expert enough in a topic to be in a position to write about it, and they forget that mere mortals don't know what they're talking about concretely, just don't know what the referent is of all of this abstract language that they bandy around with their peers, but that someone who's not a member of the clubhouse has no way of appreciating.
In your last statement, you said him or her, mm-hmm. which brings up the entire newfangled idea of using they or using only her, which you do a lot, or only him to distinguish writer and writing. Eventually, do you think we'll all just simply use they singular unless we know we're referring to a he or a she?
No, because the so-called singular they, as in everyone returned to their seats, that is often useful in getting yourself out of the sexist language trap, but it can't be used in all circumstances because sometimes you just have to keep track of a bunch of people interacting with a bunch of things and you've got to pair them up, you know, every mother with every daughter and every father with every son, and they just gets too confusing. It is often useful, and in fact, it's not even a newfangled construction. Shakespeare used it. Jane Austen used it 87 times, the singular they construction. And in fact, it's not even exclusively used to get out of the sexist language trap. People sometimes use it even when it could only be a man or it can only be a woman. I have a number of examples. The reason that it's so tempting, I mean, it comes in handy to get out of sexist language, but that's not the reason that it's in the English language, is that they isn't really referring to a bunch of people. It's really referring more to what a logician would use a variable X to do in a logical expression. So what does everyone return to their seats mean? It means for all X, X returned to X's seat. They means X. And it's a bit of a misnomer even to say that that's an error in number agreement because X doesn't have a number. It's neither singular nor plural. The whole point of X is it can refer to anything. And colloquial English presses they into service for that logical function, and that's why it's so tempting and why even great writers now and in the past have always used singular they despite what the sticklers say.
Steven Pinker. Okay, so I'm on Facebook and I write, what sets my teeth on edge is people misspelling there.
Oh, yes.
is one.
Putting in they apostrophe R-E for possessive, like their clothes.
Yeah, your is another.
Yes, right. You apostrophe R-E, your cat.
It's is another.
Yep.
And I said, what really drives me nuts, and it's something I've only seen for the past couple of years online, and I don't get it, is misspelling lose, L-O-S-E, as L-O-O-S-E. I don't know where that came from. I was an editor for 14 years. I never saw that, and now I'm seeing it everywhere.
Yeah. The interesting thing about those errors is that they're actually quite logical. We use apostrophe S as the possessive. You say, you know, Pat's chair. So why shouldn't you say, its house with an apostrophe? But you can't. It's illogical, but that's what we ended up with. Likewise, when you think about it, lose, L-O-S-E, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It looks like it should be pronounced lose, like hose. And we do have choose, C-H-O-O-S-E. And so lose with two O's quite logically could be the spelling. But again, it's one of those nagging irregularities that has been baked into the English language. Why recently, if you're right that it's a recent
seems to
spelling,
be to me, yeah.
We could check it right now on ngrams.googlelabs.com. We could actually plot the rise and fall of, or the fall and rise of say, losing. With two O's and verify it.
Really?
The only reason I bring that up is because there's a phenomenon in language commentary called the recency illusion. people always think that some change or innovation is a recent development. Now, sometimes it is, but often it's much older than you think. And what happens is we become more observant of certain kinds of errors and non-standard usages, and we project it outward. We think people are using it more and more when we've been noticing it more and more. The Google Ngram Viewer, so if you just Google Ngrams, N-G-R-A-M-S, so there's no E at the beginning. Ngram is simply a sequence of N words. So a 2-gram is a pair of words, and a 3-gram is 3 words in a row, and a 4-gram is 4 grams words in a row. Ngram is N-grams in a row. And this is a resource. I had something a little bit to do with the development of it, where after universities like Harvard scanned 5 million books, some people at Google and some of my collaborators, Erez Lieberman and Jean-Baptiste Michel, developed tools where you could search the entire contents of 5 million English books over hundreds of years and plot the rise and fall of popularity of sequences of words. And so if we wanted to look at whether Toulouse, spelled with two O's, has increased in the last 5 years, in a second we could plot that graph.
Steven Pinker. So I wrote that out and began getting all kinds of comments. Among them were, let it go, too many people are dyslexic. That was one. Another comment was, by complaining, you're showing your age.
Well, we could we could verify to see if it really is more common. You know, in general, for spelling is a kind of convention that does change slowly, and it's worth keeping just because it does derail the reader and sometimes confuse the reader if a word is misspelled. It also, you're well advised if you're a writer to avoid obvious spelling errors like lose with two O's, because simply because it's both logical but contrary to practice. What you're saying if you spell it that way is, I haven't spent a whole lot of time paying attention to the printed page. I've read the word lose, you know, thousands of times, but nah, I don't bother to remember how it's spelled. And so you're commending yourself as someone who pays attention to what they read if you spell correctly.
Things that put other people on edge. Pronouncing nuclear as nuclear.
No, that goes back decades and decades. It was an issue with Sarah Palin, so much so that she, in one of her speeches when she was vice presidential candidate, her teleprompter actually spelled out nuclear, so she wouldn't pronounce it nuclear. But it's also George W. Bush who was accused of pronouncing it that way. Before him, Jimmy Carter, a nuclear engineer. Before him, Dwight Eisenhower. So this goes way, way back. It's an understandable pronunciation change because there are lots of attracting words in the English language, like spectacular and specular, and there are very few that are pronounced like nuclear. And those little liquid consonants that are almost like vowels, L's and R's, tend to get flipped around. We talked about axe earlier and bird and brid, but it's even more common when you have sequences of vowels and liquids or semi-vowels. So, for example, jewelry. If you look the way it's spelled, it's kind of jewelry, but many people pronounce it jewelry. Or iron. Do you pronounce it iron? Many people pronounce it iron. And we don't hear it as an error, but it is a flipping of the R and the O, and then a nuclear is likewise a flipping of the L and the Y. So nuclear, nuclear. It's very easy to flip them, and people have been for at least 60 years.
And often and often, I guess, would be kind of similar in that someone's reading it or just saying it.
Well, and there are dialects of English in which it is pronounced often. Okay. I think maybe in some dialects of British English, that would be the correct pronunciation.
Over-exaggerate, same difference. Conversate and orientated.
Oh, yes. So those are two different phenomena there. One of them is back formation. That's when you take a word and you chop off a piece, not the piece that the word is originally created out of, to result in a new word. So it's orientation. If you chop off the shun, you get the verb orientate, which is a back formation. Now, by the way, orientate has been used for a long time, and if you go to pretty much any dictionary, you'll find it there. So don't try settling a bar bet that orientate is not a word by going to the dictionary. It will be there. By the way, we have lots of back formations that were objected to in their era but have become standard, like to sculpt, which comes from sculptor, or to choreograph, Originally it was choreography or choreographer, and now we forget what the fuss was about.
Over-exaggerate and same difference.
Oh, yeah, over-exaggerate, that's sometimes called a misnegation, or related to a misnegation. Sometimes people fail to keep track of how many extra noughts or other logical modifiers go into words. Like, can you unpeel the shrimp for me? Where it's peel would have been enough. Or there were still unpacked boxes lying around, which is really still unpacked boxes. But people lose track of how many uns it requires. And over can work the same way. Same difference. So it's logically it would be no difference or same thing. There it may even have originated in a bit of jocularity, and it might be a bit humorless to complain about the illogic of same difference if it was originally intended as a bit of a joke.
Alls with apostrophe, as in alls you have to look forwards to.
Yeah, that I've occasionally seen that. There's no end to the kind of peeves that people come up with.
But overall, it seems that what happens, what you're saying, is that there's a certain point, if something is, quote, wrong, where it kind of hits our brain, and at that point it stops us. And that stopping us is itself kind of a block to communication and coherence, because we suddenly have to think extra hard and kind of twirl things around in our brain.
That's right, and that's why a careful writer is well advised to spell correctly, punctuate correctly. Now, granted, what's correct can change over time. And if enough people do it the, quote, wrong way, it's no longer wrong. That's just the way language works. There's no one in charge. And if you're in a transitional period, then it can be very disconcerting. Sometimes there will be a flip, and what used to be considered wrong now becomes right. At other times, the error persists at a low level, kind of like fighting off a virus that doesn't quite go away, but it hangs around for a long period of time.
So on some level, the Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century will probably be obsolete by the Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 22nd Century.
Almost certainly.
Steven Pinker, I'd like to talk about a few other ideas now that I have you here. George Lakoff, who's also a cognitive scientist, talks a lot about framing, particularly in political issues. I know you and he have had some back and forth on that. What's your perspective on Lakoff and his ideas about framing?
Well, I think that Lakoff has made a brilliant contribution to our understanding of language and mind in showing how pervasive families of related metaphors are in everyday speech. We use metaphor even when we don't realize it, and they're not just literary tropes, but they gravitate around a single image. So one of his famous examples is that we discuss argument as if it was a kind of war. He attacked my position, but I defended it, and then he devastated me, and I retorted with this counterattack. And it isn't just one figure of speech. And you can generate new ones. Well, I think I have a hardened bunker that will make my argument unassailable. And so it's not the metaphors that we learn, but it's the central image. And he suggests, and I think there's a lot of insight in this, that a lot of our abstract thought is based on concrete physical experiences. This could be in the development of a person as we grow up from childhood. It could be in our evolution as a species, that evolution gave us certain elementary concepts like combat, like physical location, like causality, like force, and our abstract ideas consistent in co-opting them for other purposes. And I think that's a genuine insight, and we owe George Lakoff a lot for discovering how many conceptual metaphors there are. It's almost impossible to have a conversation without using them. In my book, The Stuff of Thought, I go over the Declaration of Independence and find that the first couple of sentences, pretty much every word is a metaphor. When in the course of human events, a course originally, at least historically, referred to a pathway. And event originally meant to appear, to make an appearance physically, etc. I think Lakoff takes it too far when he gives advice to political strategists to try to change people's minds by euphemism and verbal engineering. So, for example, instead of Democrats acknowledging that tax increases are a bad thing, they should refer to taxes as membership fees. And then that would make it seem less scary. You're reframing it. That's kind of doesn't pass the giggle test. People aren't that easily flipped in terms of how they conceptualize a situation. You can't just play with the words and hope that people will construe things differently.
Metaphor functions organically. You can't suddenly force it down someone's throat.
That's right. And also, I think you can take Lakoff's insight too far. It is true that many, maybe most of our abstract language can be traced back to physical concrete metaphors. But the ones that become frozen in the language need not call to mind the original image. If I say that he attacked my argument, I'm not really thinking of someone, you know, flailing with his fists. If I were to coin a new metaphor, if I were to say he put his built a hardened bunker for his argument, then I might visualize a bunker. But the vast majority of our metaphors have become dead metaphors. And so I think it's an exaggeration to say that we're constantly forming images of physical interactions every time we understand something abstract.
But what he's saying also is that on some level the right wing is doing a better job of finding metaphors than, say, liberals.
Yes, and that was a more convincing argument in the first decade of the 20th century when George W. Bush was president. And now we've had, it'll be 8 years of a Democratic president, and one of the houses controlled by the Democrats. So they couldn't be doing that bad a job anymore.
Steven Pinker, The Better Angels of Our Nature, in that book you talk about decline of violence in our society. But then I start looking at the Middle East, I start looking at the wars, and I keep thinking maybe just because in the United States things seem better, you're drawing too many conclusions?
No, it's not a book about the United States. It's a book about the whole world. It's actually not a book about the United States. And in many regards, the United States is in the rear guard of many of these trends. It's the United States that, unlike any Western democracy, still has capital punishment, is more likely to get involved in wars, has much more corporal punishment, both in schools and by parents. So by the standards of Europe, we're actually a bit in the rear guard. So no, it's not a book about the United States. It's a book about the world. And if you pick the most violent part of the world, you'll find that, yeah, it's violent. And all that means is that violence hasn't gone to zero. The only way you can say anything about global trends and violence is to look at the whole world.
And from that perspective, you see, putting aside pockets like, say, you know, ISIS, for example, that if you're looking at the larger picture and ignoring, you know, how governments would respond in a war, that you're generally just seeing less violence.
We know if you include how governments respond in a war.
Including how governments.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Otherwise, that would be leaving a very big part of the picture out, because governments, you know, it's governments that create the worst wars. But they've been doing so less and less. When it comes to war, the decline really began after World War II, so in the last two-thirds of a century. But if you plot the number of deaths in war over the last two-thirds of a century, it's a bit of a roller coaster, but it's one that goes downward. That is, there are peaks and valleys, but with an unmistakable and massive downward trend. The number of people who die in wars is a fraction of what it used to be.
But there's no way of knowing if those numbers will go in reverse. All you're looking at is what's happened since then, though.
Yes, there's no way of knowing with certainty, but I think it's a very good bet. If you're a betting person, I think it's a good bet that Western Europe will not have a war, that France and Germany won't go to war again, even though they did so for literally for millennia. In South America, there have not been wars between two countries for quite a long time. China has stayed out of war for three decades, better than the United States. Again, it's misleading to say that the United States is at the forefront of this trend. It really isn't. So large parts of the world that used to be constantly at war have kind of given it up. Now, they might take it up again, but I'd bet a fair amount of money that France and Germany won't go to war, or Germany and Poland.
Do you think it's because we burned it out of ourselves as a species?
Well, in a way, although it isn't just that we had such a bad war that we thought, gee, let's not do that again, because it didn't work so well after World War I, and that was a pretty nasty war. Although, to be honest, or to be complete, I should say, there was an enormous amount of anti-war sentiment after World War I because it was such a calamity. And some historians say that if it wasn't for Hitler, there would have been no World War II in Europe, that everyone else pretty much was sick of it. But yeah, after World War II, mechanisms were put in place to try to make it less likely, such as what became the European Union. If you have countries that are trading a lot with each other, they're less likely to invade each other, and that turns out to be, on average, true. Such as UN peacekeeping forces. They don't always keep the peace, but they do more often than not. Such as the ideal that you don't invade your neighbors and take over chunks of territory, which by and large has held. A larger and larger percentage of the world's wars are civil wars as opposed to wars of conquest. And it's just been established as a norm. You don't do that. And in fact, countries have done that a lot less. You don't have countries getting swallowed whole and going out of existence the way you did for most of human history.
In Wikipedia, it says that you have said you're neither leftist nor rightist. You're more libertarian than authoritarian.
Yeah, that's the result. I took a questionnaire, and that's where it placed me.
Where do you, as a cognitive scientist, deal with how people should respond to either income inequality or global warming?
You know, I can't say that cognitive science forces a particular opinion on that. So, I mean, any opinions I have would be my own. Do you mean why has it been so hard for people to accept global warming,
to act on either of these? It feels like in the case of global warming and income inequality, it's happening around us, but we feel powerless. Is there anything that a cognitive scientist could teach us?
Well, for global warming, huge chunks of the population do believe that there has been human-caused global warming and that it will be a problem. There are, of course, some special interests that have a stake in preventing their action. Probably the biggest factor is what moral tribe you align with. It's not really a question of being persuaded by facts or not, but rather, do people who you think are generally good people believe it or not? I think that pushes around people's opinions a lot more than the actual data. Some people say that the worst thing that happened to the climate change movement was when Al Gore did An Inconvenient Truth, the movie and book, because it made it a left-wing cause. And if you're not left-wing, then you think, well, if Al Gore likes it and he's a Democrat, then I'm not going to like it because he represents everything I don't like. And to the extent that we can depoliticize it, so for example, have well-known movement conservatives say that it is a problem that has to be dealt with, that is more likely to turn around people who don't believe it than throwing more data at them.
So that would be sort of similar to gay marriage.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's astonishing what a quick turnaround there has been for gay marriage. It wasn't that long ago in which this was an unthinkable policy change. Bill Clinton certainly stayed away from it, and he was far more liberal than his predecessor or successor. That's one bit of psychology that's relevant to political opinion and political change.
Steven Pinker, we've been talking a lot about writing and about some of these other ideas involved in how we think. When you're writing or when someone is writing, how do you avoid, if you're really passionate about something, being preachy?
Mm-hmm. You have to treat your reader with the respect of someone who is as smart and as honest as you, but may not know some things that you know, or may not have thought through, taken a particular line of argument in a particular direction. This relates to a general philosophy of writing that I endorse in the book called Classic Style, where the pretense that you adopt as a writer, and you have to adopt a pretense because your reader isn't with you there, you've got to pretend that you're in some relationship with a reader, and the question is, what is that relationship? And the one that I think leads to the best style is that you assume that your reader is your equal, that you have seen something, an objective fact about the world that they have not yet noticed, and your task as a writer is to position the reader so that she can see it with her own eyes. And that's the guiding image of prose. And I think that goes a long part of the way to avoiding preachiness, even when you do have an argument you want to press.
Is there any point in arguing with somebody who disagrees with you online?
It depends. There can be, depending on the person, depending on the issue, depending on how much time you have. People do have the bad habit of deciding their position first and then, like a hired lawyer, amassing as many arguments as they can for it and figuring out ways of undermining arguments against it. That's not a way of getting to the truth, but that's, I think, the natural way that humans act. To undermine that, to get us away from the stereotype of lawyers and closer to the ideal of disinterested scientists, who ideally scientists don't all too often don't really behave this way, but they all agree they should act this way, is you let the facts and the arguments determine what you believe.
But of course, these days, given what's available on the Internet, we're sometimes looking at different sets of facts.
Yes, so that's why it is crucial to have resources that are at least perceived as more or less neutral. I mean, and Wikipedia has done a remarkable job at attaining that status. Rumor debunking sites like Snopes.com and sites that get a reputation and deserve the reputation for highlighting vetted fact as opposed to superstition, rumor, and talking points.
Steven Pinker, now you've written Sense of Style. Where do you think you're going to go next in terms of writing? Are you writing another book now?
Oh, I probably will. I think I'll probably develop some ideas that I published in the New Republic about a year ago on science, reason, and human values, on how science and reason and humanism, that is, promoting human flourishing, ought to be recognized as our source of values and meaning in life. I think there's been a lot of demonization of science, some from the right, but a lot from the left, and that I think that's where we should look to human improvement.
You've been listening to an interview with Steven Pinker, whose latest book is titled The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.